Well, good morning, or good afternoon, I guess. It's my pleasure to be with you. It's such a delight for me to come to DBU. I've been so blessed to get to know a number of the faculty members and some of the students in the last few years. And what I so enjoy about this institution is there is a heart here to know God. There's a heart here to build our lives based on biblical truth. And that really resonates with me as I have grown along in life. I've become clearer and clearer in my own thinking about the critical importance of biblical worldview in everything that I do. And so as I developed my consulting practice over the last 20 years, and that became very clear to me, I have become more and more fanatical in my own perspective about how biblical worldview must undergird everything that I do. So today I'm going to talk to you about biblical worldview, and I'm going to talk to you about how to apply it to organizations of all types to build great organizations, organizations that would honor God, and organizations that line up with God's principles. I think it's probably clear to all of us that if we want to be blessed, we need to line up with how God designed the universe to operate. For example, if I try to oppose gravity, that's probably not going to work real well. Suppose I decide to jump off this building, we all know what's going to happen. Okay? Well, so I'm going to line up with the reality of gravity, and I'm not going to oppose what God made, and that was the gravitational force. Well, that is true in all of life. It is true in your personal life. It is true in your church life. It is true in your business life. We always want to find out what are the principles that God has ordained for us to follow in whatever realm of life we're in. So let me start by telling you a little story about an email I got a few months ago. An architect had been reading my book. Maybe a dangerous thing to do, but the book is called Beyond Babel, and this book presents a biblical model for building great organizations, and the architect wanted to build a great organization biblically. He had become convicted that that's what he needed to do, so he was reading my book, and he's trying to now expand his practice, and he came across this principle about yoking. And particularly, he was reading the text in my book in 2 Corinthians 6:14, which says this. It says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers, for what righteousness and wickedness have in common, or what fellowship can light have with darkness? And so he read that, and he went to his pastor. Now, please, I'm not being negative about pastors here, okay? But he went to his pastor and said, look, I've been reading this book about being equally yoked, and it looks like I've got some principles here I need to follow, and he's building his argument out of this text in 2 Corinthians 6. What do you think? And the pastor said, well, that really only applies to marriage. And so the guy writes me an email and says, my pastor says this verse only applies to marriage. So I write back. I said, well, can you look in the context, and anywhere in that context, can you find where it restricts that verse to marriage? And he wrote me back. He says, well, I've looked at the preceding chapter and the subsequent chapter, and I looked throughout this chapter. I can't find any restriction here. I said, neither can I. And I went on to say, you know, I grew up like you did, where I was taught this verse referred to marriage. But I can't see in the context that that's true. So this must be a very general principle, like gravity. So what does this mean, and how do we practice this? What does it mean to do not be yoked together with unbelievers? What does that mean? How do I practice that? And so that's really what I want to talk to you today, is about bringing that reality into building organizations, building your family, building your churches, building this institution here, building a business, building a government agency, building a school, building anything, bringing this reality of do not be yoked together with unbelievers. How do we do that? So that's really the key crux of the presentation today. Now, before I jump into that, let me just set this in context. This is my model that's presented in my book. It's a five-step model. The foundation of the model here is a biblical worldview. It's a question of philosophy, values, and principles. It's a question of how you go about conducting business. Isn't it interesting that corporate America today, just about any major corporation that you want to pick, you go to their website and you go to corporate governance, what are you going to find? A statement of ethics, a statement of conduct. And you go start reading that conduct statement, and what do you find? You will find biblical values, Corporate America has figured out gravity in the corporate world, and it is biblical values. Now, they don't tell you it's biblical values, but that's what it is. It's largely the golden rule. Treat people the way you want to be treated. And so what we have is corporate America, without saying so, adopting biblical values because that's the only thing that works. Sin does not work. Lying, cheating, stealing, you know, manipulating, that does not work. Now, you might have a short-term success in sin. You might go out and rob a bank and get away with it today. Okay, then what happens? You rob it again, maybe again. You keep getting away with it, and eventually you get caught because sin does not work. And that's the reality. The only thing that works long-term are God's principles. So the foundation of my model is a biblical worldview of reality, which is biblical values, biblical principles. The next step is, who are the leaders? An organization has got to have leaders who are equally yoked so they can begin to pull together, and we're going to show you what that looks like in a minute, pull together to accomplish the purpose of the organization. They've got to be able to discern what God has called the organization to do. And this is a big point here. Most of us don't see organizations as being ordained by God. Most of us think God ordained the church, maybe. And maybe he ordained my life, but does he really ordain organizations? Well, you read texts like in Daniel chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar got a real dose of gravity. And here was the dose. Nebuchadnezzar thought that he had created this great nation. And so God sent him a reality check. Here's the reality check, Nebuchadnezzar. You're not in charge. You didn't create yourself. You didn't create this organization. I did. And what I'm going to do to show you I'm in charge is you're going to be an animal, effectively, for 7 years, and then you're going to humble yourself. And that's what he did. And that's where Nebuchadnezzar learned the reality is God ordains everything. Well, God ordains your business, your organization, whoever you're with, God is there ordaining it. And when you have godly men and women who are discerning the will of God for the organization, they put together a strategic plan that reflects the will of God. And then the next element is executional excellence. Now, this is where most of our business school curriculum focuses. It focuses on the how-to, the mechanics of how to build great organizations, which is important. But you see, it's just one element in the model. And finally, the real validation that you've really heard God is the feedback from your customers. As you're serving them, what are they saying? How are they responding? Are they being blessed? And if they're being blessed, then guess what? They're going to favor you. They're going to gladly pay for your services. Recently, I had an experience where I was asked to come out and do a consulting engagement with a client on the West Coast. It was a new client that didn't know me, and so I was trying to be generous about how I would engage with this person. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a 50% discount. Okay, that's a huge discount. And so, but I wanted to show him and demonstrate value. So I go out there, I spent 2 days with him, and he was just blown away by the 2 days of what we did. I came back, made my invoice out, put my discount on it, I sent it out to him by email. He sends me back an email and says, I'm declining your discount. I'm going to pay you the full amount of your invoice, and I'm going to tell you this, it's still a bargain. I said, well, that's great. When you have that kind of thing going on, you're delivering a great value proposition. You've got very happy customers, and they're saying nice things about you. By the way, that's the greatest way to market right there, have happy customers. So this is the model that I focus on in the book and would submit to you as a great way to build any organization. Now, what we want to focus on today is the step two, which is building an equally yoked leadership team. How do we do that? Well, let me just give you some definitions here first. Okay, a leadership team is two or more people who are walking together, equally yoked in their C4 purposes. Now, I'm going to tell you what C4 is in a second. Have discerned the Lord's will or purposes for the organization and are committed and accountable to executing the Lord's purpose for the organization. So that's my definition here of a leadership team. It's people, two or more people walking together equally yoked in their C4 purpose, have discerned the Lord's will and purpose for the organization, and are committed and accountable to executing. So the criteria for determining whether or not one is equally yoked is C4. So let me tell you what C4 is. I know most of you are immediately thinking, well, that's explosive. Well, to the military, it is explosive. And to us, it is very powerful. I think when you see this principle and you begin to think about applying this principle in your life, you will see there's incredible power here. First, the first C is calling. This is the cry of the heart. God has put in you, in your heart, destiny and purpose. You are not an accident. One of the travesties about the theory of evolution is it gives us the impression that we are the product of slime and time. We are the product of the intentional creative work of the Creator of the universe. That puts incredible dignity and significance in every human life. And that's why it is so important that we get it. We count. One of the lies that Satan is trying to say to every one of us is, you don't matter. You are a nothing. And if you buy that lie, guess what? You will act that out. But when you begin to embrace the reality that you've been created intentionally and purposefully by God to do His bidding, then suddenly life becomes very significant, no matter who you are or what you do. So you've got to uncover first the cry of your heart. What has God put in your heart for you to do? The second thing is character. Character essentially is biblical worldview, because that's the only worldview that works. And everybody lives out of their worldview. Your character defines your values and the principles that you practice in life. And one of the interesting things about looking at companies, and I spend a lot of time reading and studying companies, is to see how companies are beginning to understand the importance of character. In fact, Southwest Airlines has gotten very clear on this. Most companies, when they go to hire somebody, what do? They look for capability, right? They sit down and do a job description and list all the skills they're looking for in this position. Well, the first thing Southwest Airlines does is they look for character alignment. That is very wise, because they know it's very hard to shape character. We can train skills, but it's very hard to change your worldview and your value system. You are who you are. So this character, in my opinion, is the driving, primary, and first criteria you look at in anybody, is what is their character. Thirdly is capability. This is your God-given skill and ability. God has given everybody gifts and abilities, and God works on this this principle that He doesn't give you what you don't need. It's like He's intentional. If He wants you to be a quarterback, you probably can throw the ball pretty well, but you probably can't do other things well. If He wants you to be an accountant, you're probably real good at mathematics, but you're probably not very good at marketing. You ever see an accountant try to do marketing? It doesn't work very well. And vice versa. You've seen a marketing person try to do accounting. It doesn't work. Well, that's God's intent and purpose. That's gravity in the business world. That's the way God made it to be. Okay? Then you have commissioning. Commission is the external validation of authority figures that you are doing what God's called you to do. Everybody in this room has seen people doing things they're not supposed to do. And what do? You kind of just stand back and let them do it, don't you? Have you ever thought maybe what you ought to do is ask the Lord, Lord, am I supposed to say something? And if you feel the leading of the Spirit to say something to that person. You know, and challenge them. Are you really supposed to be doing this? So this is the C4 principle: calling, character, capability, commissioning. Now the principle can be found, probably the clearest text that I found is in Exodus chapter 35 and 36. God is wanting to build a tabernacle. And so this text tells us how He decided to choose who would build the tabernacle. So you say, okay, what was His criteria for selecting workers? What was His criteria for hiring? Well, what you'll find is the C4 principle. At the very top, you'll see, first of all, see the Lord has chosen Bezalel. Well, chosen, that is talking about calling. What has God chosen you to do? And there's another aspect of calling that's down here in the bottom. It says, and who was willing? Now, that word willingness is a little bit misleading in the English, because it's the Hebrew word lib, which means heart. And it has an implication of great passion and fervency, which the term willing doesn't lend to us. So this is he's asking for people who are passionate about doing this work. So there you have the calling as a criteria for people that are going to build the tabernacle. Then you have the character. Notice what it says there. He says he's filled him with the Spirit of God. You think if you were filled with the Spirit of God, you might have impeccable character? I don't think you could have any better character than being filled with the Spirit of God. So that's what he's looking for. Have you ever thought about hiring people based on them being filled with the Spirit of God? Is that a new idea? To most people, it is. I mean, they look at that and say, wait a minute, I just want a good worker. You know, that's what Henry Ford said back in 1926. I just want a pair of hands. And what he was saying was, when I hire somebody, I hire everything. I hire their worldview. I don't want their worldview. I just want their hands. But you can't hire a person without hiring their worldview. So the reality is you want to hire people of great character. And this is what God did. He hired people that were full of his Spirit to work on his tabernacle. And then he says, with skill, ability, and knowledge of all kinds of crafts, that's the capability. You have to have the skill to do it. And finally, there's the commissioning. Notice what it says here. To do the work just as the Lord has commanded. Commissioning is about authority figures saying, you do this. This is what I am directing you to do. It's releasing us to do what God's called us to do. So that's the C4 principle right there in Exodus chapter 35. Now, it can be found in other texts, but this is probably one of the clearest examples. Now, in the prior text, you will note that there was unity in calling, character, and commissioning. That is, you are called, you got to find what's in your heart. Everybody needs to find out what's in their heart. Everybody needs to have the character of a biblical worldview, and everybody needs to be commissioned. So that's all unitary. But in capability, we have diversity. You want diverse skill and ability. You have all these different kinds of needs in building the tabernacle, so you need to be sure you have all of those bases covered. So what you have here is the concept of the body. That is, we're not all a hand, we're not all a foot, we're not all a leg, we're not all a head. We have different parts, and the different parts have different purposes. And the purpose is that all the parts will work together for the good of the whole. And so that's what you see in 1 Corinthians 12, which is probably one of the clearest texts about the importance of parts. In business, there are three basic functions. I don't care what kind of business it is, where it is, any place in the world, there are three basic functions. I was talking to a client in Switzerland yesterday, and he's got the same issue that my client in Alaska has. Three basic functions to their business. You got to get work, you got to do work, and you got to keep score. And the skills that you need for those three functions are different. The get work person is your sales and marketing person. And that's different from the do work guy, which is your operations person who's going to take care of the details. And it's different from your scorekeeper who's going to keep track and tell you how you're doing. Different skills are required. You have to all work together. And that's God's system. That's gravity in the marketplace. Understand God's system. And so that's what this reality is expressing. Equally yoked teams embrace diversity and capability, but unity of calling, character, and commissioning. Now, I couldn't resist this. I got to do a little vector analysis here just so I feel at home again. Okay? So I won't dwell on this. I did this for a group of pastors back in the summer, and they didn't get it at all. So I'm trusting that you all are brighter and you can get this. But this is really kind of cool. The expression, being equally yoked, it's an agrarian term. It's a term that a farmer would use. And if you're plowing a field, your objective to plow the field, get the plow on the ground, and plow a straight line to the end of the field. Isn't that your objective? Okay, so that's, and you've got, let's say you've got two sources of energy, two oxen, two cattle, or two whatever, and you yoke them together so you can get the benefit of the two of them working together. And so that's what you have here, is you've got two sources of energy. You got one here, both of them the happy faces, they're happy workers. And they're yoked together by this little blue line, that's the yoke. And you see this line right here represents the force vector from the center of mass. Now, I know all of you have had physics, so you know what center of mass means. So that represents the energy, the force that you're able to exert to plow the ground. Now, each source of energy is not plowing along this force vector. They're plowing to the side. So they have to pull a little bit out to be able to keep going because they're yoked together with each other. In other words, to some degree, they're fighting each other. That's just the nature of being yoking. Again, that's another point of gravity and how God made the world to work. And so they have this little balancing force here. So basically, their force vector for each one is like this, and it has two components. It has a component parallel to what you're trying to do and perpendicular. The perpendicular is the balancing. Now, what you want to do is keep the balancing force to a minimum. Because what happens is the balancing force. The bigger it is, the more your losses are. And the more losses you have, the less efficient the system is. So you want them as equally yoked as possible. You want the same kind of animals. You want them to be the same age, roughly the same size, the same strength. You want both of them to be well and well fed and well rested. You want them to be as equally yoked as you can so you can keep them going in a straight line. Let's say that you have one of them that's weak and the other strong. Well, the strong one then is trying to make up for the weak one. And all this energy is going into balancing the system to try to keep it going in a straight line. And suddenly that force vector in the middle comes way down because the energy is going now out perpendicular to balance things. So you see the picture there? I know that may be a little... Those of you that are physics students, I expect you to get this. This will be on the test. Okay? All right? The more unequally yoked a system is, the less efficient it is what the bottom line is. So that's why it's important that you be equally yoked. All right, let me just give you some characteristics of what equal yoking looks like as you begin to apply the C4 principle. And you can apply it in any context. You can apply it in your family, in your church, in this institution, in your business, in your community, wherever you are, wherever you're yoked together with people, you can find these characteristics. So first is calling. And in an equally yoked team, what you're going to find is you're going to find passion. Everybody on the team is passionate about being where they are and doing what they're doing. And an unequally yoked team, you're going to find no passion. Now, you might find some have passion and some don't. What happens when you have the ones that don't are killing the ones that do? Those of you that have experienced that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I was talking to a client this week, and he's had an unequally yoked person for some time. And one of the things about consultants is we get to talk to clients over and over again about the same things. And they pay us to do that. So over and over again, I'm telling him, you know, this guy is not equally yoked, and here are the reasons. We're going through the argument. And finally, the client, you know, decides to do it. And as soon as he decided to do it, all of a sudden, the production of the company went up. His costs go down. I said, isn't that great? You were paying for dysfunctionality. That's what was going on. And that's what happens in most organizations because we wind up with people that have no passion to be there. And they pull down everybody else. So passion is huge. Look for passion as a key. Now, character, I've got several components here. And by the way, this is not an exhaustive list. This is just intended to give you a sense of how to look at your team and look at these characteristics and kind of assess how equally yoked are we. All right, how about this one? Excuse making. That's a big one. That goes back to Genesis 3. You know, when God's calling Adam and Eve into account, oh, well, it was the woman. The woman. Oh, it was the serpent. And as they said, the serpent didn't have a leg to stand on. So it goes down the chain. Well, guess what? We are descendants of Adam and Eve. We are excuse makers. So in an equally yoked team, what you have is mature people that says, I'm going to take responsibility. I'm not going to make excuses. On an unequally yoked team, you have a bunch of excuse makers. How about problem solving? Key to problem solving is get to the root. Don't deal with the symptoms. Equally yoked teams deal with root issues. Unequally yoked teams deal on the symptom level. Personal agendas. This is huge. Everybody's got a personal agenda. But if you're going to work for the good of the whole, you subordinate your personal agenda. It's not about you. It's about the organization, the objectives of the organization. An equally yoked team, personal agendas are subordinated to the good of the organization. In an unequally yoked team, what you have is individuals are driving their own personal agendas. That's what they're executing. And now you're destroying the ability to work together as a team. How about the definition of success? An equally yoked team, success is the team wins. An unequally yoked team is the individual wins. So are you about your individual accomplishments, your individual resumes, or are you about helping the team win? Results-driven. Equally yoked teams are very results-driven. Now, please don't misunderstand this. It's not all about the numbers, but the numbers do count. You can't ignore the numbers. And the teams that are truly equally yoked set goals and objectives that are clear. They have metrics to measure whether or not they reach those goals, and they hold themselves accountable. In an unequally yoked team, what you have with results is confusion. You never have clarity. You never know, did we really get there or not? Now, how about capability? Strategy and commitment is a hallmark of an equally yoked team. An equally yoked team cannot help but get clear about what they're doing. They are very focused. An unequally yoked team lacks focus. Then you have executional excellence. you will see an equally yoked team figuring out ways to execute the value proposition, whatever it is, very, very well. And an unequally yoked team, they're not all that concerned, and that will show up then with the customer satisfaction. In the equally yoked team, the customers are very happy, and the unequally yoked teams, customers are not happy. Has anybody experienced that? Probably one of the greatest example of this is dealing with technology companies today. I mean, how many of y'all have called a technology company to buy something? You get an 800 number, and you get answered pretty quickly. And boy, they're fast about getting your credit card number and sending you the product. And then you have a problem with the product, and you want to call customer service. What happens? There's no 800 number. You get the call and pay the long-distance nickel, and then you get in a queue for 10, 20, or 30 minutes. And that's just to get to the first level, and usually they can't help you. So what happens? And then you got to elevate you. So you wind up spending 2 or 3 hours solving a problem. How do you feel about that? Is that good or not? Hopefully, you see, that does not create customer satisfaction. And how about commissioning? What you see, whenever a person is commissioned, there is unity. There's a bond that happens. When you feel that you've been commissioned to do something by somebody, it could be a parent, it could be a coach, it could be a teacher, it could be a boss, it can be a pastor, anybody. When you feel that, there's a bond that happens. What happens when you don't feel that unity is you have conflict. Probably one of the first things that I see in unequally yoked teams is conflict. And conflict is all about protecting yourself. This is not a safe place. I had a lady one time tell me about a church experience she had. She said, "That is not a safe church." I said, "Why is it not safe?" "Because you have to protect yourself. You can't go in there and trust anybody. There's no unity. There's no bond there." And that happens in any kind of organization. If you don't have, if you can't build a bond of unity, you will have conflict. Then you have trust. Now, trust is not, let me just define this for you. Trust is not, can I trust you to take a deposit to the bank? I assume that most of you are trustworthy in that regard. You could take a deposit to the bank, you wouldn't steal. That's not what I'm talking about. Trust I'm talking about is, can you trust the person to do their job in the best interest of the organization? You hear that? That's a different level of trust. Are they the right person to do whatever it is they've been assigned to do? So trust is very important. If you have no trust, that leads you to micromanagement. And micromanagement is all about saying, I don't trust you, so I'm going to come in and try to direct you. That's another sign of unequally yoked teams. Finally, healthy collaboration. What you see with equally yoked teams is very healthy collaboration. With unequally yoked teams, you do not see it because everybody is dealing with their personal agendas and you have elephants and sacred cows. Now, elephants are topics that we cannot discuss, but everybody knows about them. It's like the elephants in the room, but we cannot talk about the elephant. Okay? Sacred cows are people that are untouchable. They're people that are in the organization that shouldn't be in the organization. They're out of place. There's something wrong, but they're being protected by the higher-ups, so they are untouchable. These are killers. They kill the ability of the organization to work well because it leads to unequal yoking. Now, I want to give you just an example of equal yoking. I want to talk to you about a plant. This is the GE jet engine plant in Durham, North Carolina. Now, let me just say this. This plant is an anomaly even for GE, which is known to be a fairly good company. This plant is a superior company. It is a phenomenal company. First of all, you got to understand, there are 170 workers in this plant and one boss, who happens to be a female. Now, they put jet engines together. So, you know, there's some big guys in there. Okay? And they're working for this one female. Then you have 9 teams of people, each responsible for an engine from beginning to end. Now, these engines are the engines that go on Air Force One. They're the engines that go on the 777 that Boeing makes. They're the big engines. These engines are bigger than your biggest SUV. They are huge engines. There are 10,000 parts or thereabouts in each engine. So you're talking about a very meticulous machine that you're putting together. You have 9 teams of people, probably 12 to 15 people on a team. They're responsible from beginning to end. And notice they're giving 3 mandates. A start date, an end date, and do it right. That's it. That's the mandate. Now, they obviously know how to do it, but that's what they're charged to do. That's what they're responsible to do. Then you have division of labor. Each team figures out who does what. In other words, you don't have an assembly line here. This is not Henry Ford's style of manufacturing plant. This is a very personalized approach where this team owns that engine from start to finish. There are no time clocks. How many companies you know that don't have time clocks? Each technician takes personal responsibility for his or her work. Every time they do something, and almost everything there has to be entered in the computer because all the nuts are torqued. You know what a torque wrench is? So each nut has to be torqued exactly to the specification for that nut, and then that technician puts in, I torqued it to this level, and then his initials or her initials. And finally, the QC is driven by the standard. My child may be on the plane. That's the standard. Now, what do you think that might do to you if you're on that team building that engine and you thought, my child might be on the plane that this engine's going to go on? I'm going to be sure it's right. Everybody's checking everybody else. Now, do you see the C4 principle at work here that's creating an equally yoked team? Needless to say, this is a great company. This company's doing very well. They produce engines by the who knows how many, hundreds and hundreds of engines, and I think they do at least an engine a day, and their defect rate is, guess what? Almost nil. In fact, you know what a defect is for them? A scratch on the cowling. That's what the defect is. How often do you hear of jet engines failing as airplanes go across the Atlantic or fly across the country? Almost never. You think about the thousands and thousands of flights that happen with engines like this, and they never fail. Why is it? It's because of people like this using this kind of standard. My child may be on the plane. I'm going to do it right. So this is a huge picture of C4. So let me just show you the examples. First of all, the calling. Calling is about the passion that's in you. You see the calling there in the division of labor. When we decide who's going to do what, we figure out who has got a heart to do the various things. If you happen to be real good at one particular job, then guess what? That's yours, baby. You're going to do what you're good at because they recognize the value of people doing what's in their heart. Then you have character. Character is about taking responsibility. It's about saying it's on me. You know, we're in a very litigious world. You know, just about anything goes wrong, somebody wants to sue somebody. I was talking to a client the other day, and he had made a mistake in how he had dealt with one of his consultants. He had failed to get a contract with his consultant. And this particular client, the way he's set up, is he has an agreement that says, if I can't collect for your work, then I'm not going to pay you. And all of his consultants sign those. And the whole rationale is to encourage the consultant to be sure you're doing work that is indeed valued by the client. It's a good practice. Well, he failed to get this consultant to sign it. And so this consultant did an engagement, and the client did not value all the work that the consultant did, so they didn't want to pay for all of it. And so my client did what was right. He says, fine, we'll deduct that from the bill, and you pay with the balance. And now the consultant's coming back to my client and saying, you owe me for the balance, which is about $4,000. And my client said, well, look at the contract. And the guy says, I didn't sign the contract. And then my client comes to me and says, what do I do? And then he says to me, this guy and his wife, who is a lawyer, they're always looking for somebody to sue. I said, well, that's very interesting. It tells you a lot about their character. By the way, he's a professing Christian, if that's any consolation to you. But that's a mentality today, even among Christians, is who can I sue? Who can I blame for whatever happened to me, what went wrong with me? Do you know that's a fairly recent occurrence? If you lived 150 years ago, you wouldn't have found this going on. Because people took responsibility for their actions. Well, this plant, people take responsibility. Somebody makes a mistake, they say, hey, it's mine. I made it, I'm fixing it. Then you have capability. If you're gonna be sure this engine's going to work for your child because your child's going to be on that plane, guess what? You're going to do it right. You're going to get all the skill and ability and knowledge you need to be sure that engine's put together right. And then finally, you can see how management looks at this because management does the commissioning. Wow, I got one manager and 170 people. Now, how many management theorists would tell you one manager to 170 is right? Okay? I've never heard anybody say that. But that's what you've got. You've got one manager, 170 people, because you've got trusted teams who are equally yoked to go do this. And you see this. All they have to do is give you the strategy. Here's the big picture. Here's the start date. Here's the end date. Do it right. And guess what? I totally trust you. Don't worry about the time clocks. We're taking the time clocks out. Now, that's trust. That's what commissioning is. I trust you to do the job right. And I'm going to get out of your way. I'm not going to micromanage you. So this is an equally yoked team. Would you like to be part of this? Yeah, this would be that would be a great team to be part of. Let's look at unequal yoking. If you have people on your leadership team who do not have C4 to be on your team, you have an unequally yoked team. If you don't have C4 or somebody in your team doesn't have C4 to be on the team, you're unequally yoked. And unequally yoked teams can never be excellent. And I want to just give you some examples of how this pops up. This is an article here that by Marcus Buckingham. And what's interesting about this article is his research about what people enjoy doing. He's saying that 17% of the workers enjoy what they do. You ever thought about that? Only 17% of workers enjoy their work. Now, wow, why is that true? Why is that so? Well, let me suggest that one of the reasons that I run into over and over again is that people work for the wrong reason. Most people are working because of money. That's the reason they work. They're not working because they discern the will of God for their lives. Now, yes, you have to earn a living. Yes, we all know that. But the real driving motivation needs to be, what has God created me to do? And by the way, that's what parenting should be about. Parenting should be about discerning what God created your children to be and training them to do it. That's what education should be. Training what the students at this university got, how God has created them, and so they can be released to what God called them to do and to be. And what we have here in this country is because we're driven so much by money, people are making wrong choices about where to work, and so now we have probably 83% of the workforce in the wrong job. We need to begin to get it that God has put destiny in our hearts. And that's what this verse, Psalm 37:4, says. It says, you want to find what God wants you to do, then you need to get very, very intimate with God. Now, this word, delight yourself in the Lord, is probably not a good translation. That word, we think delight is to get all happy with God. It's not what it is. Delight means to become pliable in the hands of God. Does that sound different? It is. It is different. It's about being humble. When you get real humble and pliable, and it's suddenly not my will but your will, then guess what? You get the desires of your heart because God has put in your heart what he wants you to do. Destiny is in your heart. What clouds your ability to see your destiny is your flesh. The fleshly desires get in the way, and then we can't see what God wants us to do. So we have a real problem in this country in that we have so many people working outside of what God has called them to do. And then we have character issues. Some of you that are in business school, you may have heard of this term, emotional inefficiency. This is a new term, a new field of study. And what they're discovering is that people tend to recreate their family dynamics at the office. Surprise, surprise. And here, there was a two-year study done by Seattle Psychology. He found that whenever you bring your dysfunctionality from your childhood into your adult life and then into your work life, you bring 20 to 50% inefficiency into your work. Now, you got to think about that for a second. If you didn't learn how to handle conflict as a child, you grow up and you don't know how to handle conflict. If you didn't know how to properly submit to authority as a child, you bring that into adulthood. If you grew up in a home where you could never do enough, guess what? You're going to bring that into your management style. That's what they're talking about, this emotional inefficiency. To the degree that we did not properly grow up and learn the lessons we should learn, we bring that dysfunctionality into the workplace. That's what they're talking about. And when Scripture says train up a child in the way he should go, a big part of that is training biblical character in people. So when they become adults, they are godly people in how they see and how they act. And to the degree that we're not, we contribute to this dysfunctionality. So this is a huge part of character problems, is poor training growing up. And then we have the whole issue of marriage. How much money do you think Truett Cathy at Chick-fil-A spends to invest in marriage counseling for his workers? How much money do you think he might spend? Most companies wouldn't spend anything because we have an assumption that what happens at home has nothing to do with what happens at work. That's an unspoken assumption. You can do whatever you want in your private life, but at work you do this. It doesn't work. Whatever you do at home, you're going to do at work. Whatever you do at work, you're going to do at home. So Truett Cathy's figured this out. He spends millions of dollars each year trying to help his people have good marriages, because if they have good marriages, guess what? They bring good behavior, good productivity into the workplace. Well, not only is this a theory that he has, research has validated this. This is Scott Stanley at the University of Denver. He did some studies a decade ago, and he confirms that is indeed reality. If you've got marriage problems, that's going to come into the workplace. Those are character issues that we need to learn to deal with. Now, let me just talk to you real quickly about my own experience relative to capability and commissioning. About 20 years ago or so, when I was running the family business, I had this bright idea that I wanted to be more godly in how I ran my business. And so I thought, I'm going to hire Christians. So I found a guy that had been to seminary, and he was an engineer, and he wanted to go to work. I said, great, I can hire an engineer who's a Christian. I thought, this is wonderful. So I hired the guy, and I assigned him a workload, gave it to him, and I began to watch him, and I began to notice things were not working very well. So I began to dig into what was going on, and the more I dug in, the more I realized, this guy doesn't know how to engineer. He's got an engineering degree, but he doesn't know how to engineer. And so now, being the personality I am, I'm feeling guilty because, I didn't do a good job of doing my due diligence, and this guy is not going to cut it. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to train me to be an engineer. I can do that. Now, let me tell you how serious I am. I am not a morning person. That is not the time of day that I like. You call me at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, I'm awake, I'm alert, I can talk to you. But 6 in the morning is not my time. Well, I said, I'm so serious about helping you become an engineer, I'll meet you at 6 a.m. That means I'm getting up at 4:30. That means I just went to bed a few hours before. So I'm not getting any rest, but I'm sacrificing to train this guy to make him an engineer. This went on for week after week after week. Would it surprise you to know that it didn't take? And I didn't know it didn't take until December rolls around. He says, I've got to have surgery. I'm going to be off for the month. I said, okay, I'll take over your work. And now you find out what's below the surface. You saw the tip of the iceberg up until then. Now you get to see the 80% below the surface. It was a bigger mess than I had ever imagined. It was terrible. And I spent the whole month of December cleaning up his mess. And finally, toward the end of the month, something happened that really kind of was the icing on the cake. It's company policy that you had a company vehicle, but you could not use company gas for personal use. You could only use it for company use. Everybody knows he's off for the month of December. About the 20th of December, he comes tooling in the yard with the company car, pulls up to the gas pump, fills his car up with gas, and then he tools out. Well, guess what? About 5 guys saw him do this. And now they're all just chattering, you know. The word gets up to me that what he's just done. And, of course, I'm already pretty hot about what's happened the last 3 weeks as I've been doing his work. That was the icing on the cake. He comes back January 1st, January 2nd or 3rd, whatever it was, and reports for work. And I told my secretary, send him to my office immediately. And I had one of the engineers come in there. And I called him in. I said, look, here's the deal. I made a huge mistake. You should not be here. This is not where you're supposed to be. You're not gifted to be here, and I'm going to terminate you. He says to me, you can't fire me. I said, why? I said, I'm a Christian. I said, guess what? You're fired. And so I fired him that day, and it was the best thing I did because the guy was totally out of place. Now, he was not a bad guy. He had gifts and talents. It's just his gifts and talents did not fit what I need. He did not have the capability to do the job. Very bright guy. He was a brilliant student. He made straight A's in college. He made straight A's, you know, at a seminary. Now, I don't know how he made straight A's in engineering, but he did because he didn't know how to engineer. And the reality is the best thing I could do is tell him, you're out of place. I cannot commission you. I cannot trust you. I cannot release you to do your job. And so I'm going to release you to go find what it is you have C4 to do. By the way, that's how we should be releasing people, i.e. firing people, is releasing them to where they're supposed to be. Okay, now let me just give you another example. This is a company that called me just this past week. A president called me, and this is a new company. It's in another state. He says, you know, I've just started this service business. I want to build multiple locations, and, you know, I want to eventually go public. Now, do you think you might need an equally yoked team to do something like that? You better. Because you got a big job in your hands, build multiple locations, manage it, and then eventually go public with it. So he hires a CFO. And the CFO was a professing Christian who was an ex-missionary and had an MBA. And so hires this guy in and starts working with the guy. And the vision was the CFO would become the operations manager. So here are some of the things that the president began to see. First of all, this guy is not teachable. For whatever reason, the CFO just didn't respond to any instruction. He shunned the president's wife. And the president's wife was very involved in the company. She wasn't just casually involved. She spent time there coaching and mentoring people, training people. So she was very involved in the company, and yet the CFO kept shunning the wife. Then you have the reality he doesn't seek to learn about the operations. In other words, he kind of was confined to his office, didn't go outside of his office, was not proactive about looking for ways to improve the company. If there were people in, you know, doing various things, consultants, he just didn't engage, didn't connect at all. And finally, he was an excuse maker. It did not matter what the president said about these things. He was always making excuses. So does this guy have C4 to be part of the management team? No, he doesn't. Okay, well, just look at some of these things. Being not teachable, that's a character issue. We need to be teachable to the day we die. Nobody knows everything. Learning is a lifelong process. One of the deceptions that we buy into is that we get our degree and we stop learning, now we go to work. No, your degree is simply a license to keep learning. You never stop learning. You should be making professional development part of your life every year, continually learning. Well, this guy was not teachable. Shunning the president's wife, that is definitely a character issue. You do not shun people. I don't care who they are. You don't shun people. You treat people with respect because God made everybody. I mean, when you are disrespectful to somebody, you're being disrespectful to somebody that God has made. That is not what we should be doing. Look at this. Doesn't seek to learn about operations. There's no heart. When you have a heart to do something, what do? You learn everything you can about it. You're insatiable about finding out about it. You get on the internet, you read books, you talk to people, you learn, you do whatever you can do. You love it. You have a passion. There's no passion here. Finally, he's not proactive about finding ways to improve the company. That's a calling and capability issue. In other words, maybe he's got some capability, hasn't been developed, and maybe he doesn't have the ability at all. At least he doesn't have the heart to do it. And finally, excuse making is a character issue. So you can see character issues are the big issues that are blocking him and killing him from being effective. So there's no way this guy can be part of the team. Now, invariably in life, you're going to have situations where you're going to be unequally yoked. It's going to happen. Now, sometimes you have nothing you can do about it. You're in a position like Daniel in the book of Daniel. Daniel was in captivity. He didn't have a choice. He was in captivity. So what should he do? Well, he did what we all should do. He used the divine problem-solving methodology, which is ask, seek, knock. You have a problem, you start asking, which is praying. You start seeking, which is gathering your options. And when God opens up a door, you knock on the door and see if that's where he wants you to go. You ask, seek, knock. That's the divine methodology for solving any problem. It doesn't matter what problem it is, you can use that methodology. So that's what you should do. And then you stay in the situation until God makes a way. That's what 1 Corinthians chapter 7 has to say about that. Then what if you have a situation where you do have authority, you have the ability to make a change? What should you do? If you're the steward, by the way, I'm going to suggest that when you think about owning a company, you need to think about yourself as the chief steward. Because who really owns the company? God owns the company. Because the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. God owns everything. And so if God owns everything, he owns my business, Strategies at Work. I am the chief steward of Strategies at Work. And it's my job is to discern the will of God, what I'm supposed to do to steward that company well. So if I find myself unequally yoked in my company, what should I do? Then I better sit down and be a good steward and face the reality and develop a plan to address the problem. Because remember, unequal yoking inhibits my ability to deliver an excellent value proposition. As a steward, that's what I'm supposed to do, is deliver an excellent value proposition. So let's just summarize real quickly. Like the architect, we need to embrace biblical truth in our businesses and organizations. We got to know that God has made the principles for how businesses and organizations work, how families work, how churches work. We've got to embrace those principles. We've got to seek out those principles. Proverbs said, "It is the glory of God to conceal a matter. It is the glory of rulers to uncover, to dig it out, to find it." We are rulers. Genesis 1, verse 26 says that God created us to rule his creation. So we have the role of rulers. Doesn't matter who you are, where you are, that's part of your job. So we've got to search out the principles that God has put into the universe for us to do what we're supposed to do. So that the architect was getting onto the right page, we need to get on that page. We've got to know that excellent organizations are only built with C4 equally yoked leadership teams. Look for C4 and everybody on the team. If you got somebody that doesn't have C4, they're probably not supposed to be on the team. Now, you might have a situation where a little bit of tweaking, a little remediation, maybe they can become C4. But everybody needs to get to be C4. And finally, if you don't deal with it, what's going to happen is you're going to have a very dysfunctional, inefficient team. And all of us have seen that, very dysfunctional, inefficient organizations. When you've got that, you do not bring glory to God, because God is in to us advancing his rule and reign on this planet. And we do that by growing, multiplying, subduing, which is mastering his universe. That's our responsibility as stewards. And we do that in teams, because nobody can do it by themselves, because we don't have all the gifts. We've got to be connected together in teams to be able to do what God's called us to do. So Lord, bless you and give you grace and favor to learn how to do that well.